stuffs. And I always look back longingly to go back on the talent side. It was really the best thing happened because it taught me to deal with people. It taught me to be able to wake up in the morning and talk to a plumber, for one thing, a banker, a real estate person, and a computer person, and really be diverse in my skills. I later worked in different radio stations and, again, worked on different sides of the fence. I worked at KNX, KFWB, KABC, and finally retired as one of the few female general managers in a major market working for KMPC Sporting News Radio. Up in 2000 and 2001 when I retired. It was a wonderful career, and it prepared me for yet again another adventure. I think I'll leave it right there for you, John.
Nancy Cole Silverman, we will be sure to talk again.
Thank you.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report. Please make your contribution at 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler. Quoting from a four-year-old essay in Foreign Affairs titled U.S. Foreign Policy, Never Recovered from the War on Terror, which is still ringing very true today. Quote, with a declaration of its global war on terror after the attacks of September 11, 2001, the United States went abroad in search of monsters and ended up midwifing new ones from terrorist groups such as the Islamic State, born in the prisons of U.S.-occupied Iraq, to destabilization and deepening sectarianism across the Middle East, to that racist authoritarian movements in Europe and in the United States that feed off of the fear of refugees fleeing those regional conflicts. Advocates of the war on terror believe that nationalist chauvinism, which sometimes travels under the name American exceptionalism, could be stoked at a controlled burn to sustain American hegemony. Instead, and predictably, toxic ultranationalism burned out of control. Today, the greatest security threat to the United States comes not from any terrorist group or any great power, but from domestic political dysfunction. The election of Donald Trump as president was a product of, and accelerant of that dysfunction, but not its cause. The environment for his political rise was prepared over a decade and a half of xenophobic, messianic Washington warmongering, with roots going back into centuries of white supremacist politics, end quote. We are very fortunate to have Matt Duss with us today to discuss realities highlighted in his four-year-old yet still very prescient essay and how the U.S. not reckoning with the disastrous legacy of 9/11 has led our government to supporting an ongoing genocide in Gaza, which has now spread into a wider regional humanitarian disaster. Matt Duss is Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy. Before joining CIP, Matt was a visiting scholar at the American Stagecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. From 2017 to 2022, he was foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. From 2014 to 2017, he was the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. And for 6 years before that, Matt Duss was a national security and international policy analyst at the Center for American Progress. His work has been widely published, including in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Foreign Affairs, The Nation, The American Prospect, and Foreign Policy. It is my great pleasure to welcome Matt Duss to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you very much. Very glad to be here.
Matt, your essay, U.S. Foreign Policy Never Recovered from the War on Terror, really was a roadmap to transforming U.S. policy or U.S. foreign policy by acknowledging the failures of the War on Terror and taking an honest accounting for the destruction that it wrought. The Democrats and Joe Biden won the 2020 election, but didn't get your memo and didn't, as you wrote, quote, reckon with the scale of the disaster it has helped inflict on the world and on itself through three presidencies, end quote. And ironically, while President Biden has been saying publicly that he advised Prime Minister Netanyahu to learn from our missteps invading Iraq, how do you process his steadfast commitment this entire year to continue supplying the bombs and the fighter jets to drop them from on densely populated civilian areas unconditionally, even as one red line after another that he has set has been crossed?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few ways to answer that question. First off, you know, I do think, you know, President Biden, as you noted, in the wake of October 7, he said that he was trying to kind of use America's own experience to warn Israel from making some really bad mistakes. And yet it's unclear to me if Biden fully understands the scope of those mistakes. I mean, I do appreciate and acknowledge that he withdrew from Afghanistan. Of course, the way that was done was not the best way. I think there's lots of criticisms to be made, legitimate criticisms of the way that withdrawal was handled, though I'd also know that losing a war is never pretty, and that is, in fact, what happened in Afghanistan, unfortunately, for the people of the United States and for the people of Afghanistan. But when he withdrew from Afghanistan, he made a remark that I remember where he talked about, you know, ending America's endless war. And this is something he had committed to on the campaign trail, that a lot of activists and others, grassroots organizers, veterans groups had urged not only Biden, but all of the Democratic primary candidates, including Senator Sanders, who was the first member of the Senate to make that commitment to end the forever wars. The forever wars is not one war. The forever war is it's a concept that includes a whole range of wars and conflicts. It's just a way of approaching national security with this, you know, using small forces, special forces, basically sending U.S. troops various places. U.S. troops are engaged again in anti-terrorism missions in dozens of countries right now. Even those are not open hot wars, they are still, you know, operating under the two authorizations of military force passed in the wake of 9/11. So just saying that now, with regard to the way that you know, Biden has handled Netanyahu, yes, he has said things, words of caution. He has said good things about protection of civilians. He has not used America's leverage to actually push back in any meaningful way on what was very clearly and very early just massive violations of human rights, massive ongoing systemic violations of international humanitarian law. We would see these regular, and we still see these regular leaks of how the president had a very stern phone call with Netanyahu. He's very upset now. Be rest assured, he's very upset. But I don't really care how upset he is. What I want him to do is create consequences for these actions, and that is what he has not done. And I think there are several reasons for this. The most important is just Biden has a deep ideological bias toward Israel, but also a deeply held views about how the U.S.-Israel relationship is supposed to work, and that is that U.S. support for Israel is essentially unconditional. There is really nothing any Israeli prime minister can do that would cause Joe Biden to kind of withdraw and support or really diminish support in any real way. You know, President Biden did suspend the provision of the largest bombs, 2,000-pound bombs, a few months ago, but, you know, really continued and actually accelerated the provision of other weapons.
Right.
And I think we see the result. You know, I think I'll just, my last point here is there's a quote that I often refer to from Barack Obama during the 2008 primary. In one of the primary debates, I think it was in January 2008, he was talking about the Iraq war, and he said, I don't want to just end this war. I want to end the mindset that got us into this war in the first place. And unfortunately, I think Joe Biden has shown that he is pretty much just the embodiment of that mindset. Like, we can go deeper into what that mindset is about. But, you know, let's remember that Joe Biden still to this day has never fully accounted for his support for the Iraq War, which he played a key role in enabling. As the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, his explanation for that was essentially that he was misled by President George W. Bush, which is just a transparently silly excuse. And in the similar vein, he was not misled by Netanyahu, you know, despite the fact that he wants to keep, you know, creating this impression that he's frustrated and Netanyahu keeps kind of, you know, hoodwinking him. He's very clearly, even if he would not prefer this war to escalate, he is simply not using the leverage that America has to prevent that. So he is clearly complicit in what we're seeing.
That's right. You know, you also wrote about how the war on terror became a route through which open racism was smuggled back into mainstream U.S. politics. And we now see that is on steroids, racing towards the finish line of the 2024 elections. Do you think that that's because we also have never honestly accounted for the legacy and destruction that was wrought by ethnic cleansing and slavery in this country?
I think that's part of it. And again, I think it really is important to note that this doesn't trace just back to 9/11. 9/11 kind of prized open a lot of really ugly traditions in American politics that have a long history. And I would give a recommendation for my good friend Spencer Ackerman's book, Reign of Terror, which is a really excellent book and a really deep, great reporting, great journalism, great history, research into U.S. history that draws some of the connections here. And I think a much more granular way. But yeah, I mean, if you saw in the wake of 9/11, it's understandable, a very painful day, a shocking day, serious national trauma. Those images played over and over and over again. Everyone can probably see them in their minds right now, of people leaping to their deaths from the Twin Towers. But just this kind of jingoism and xenophobia that then was just pouring out of the mouths of our leaders to justify, the coming wars, that is, that in a lot of ways kind of laid the groundwork for Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump has always kind of engaged in this kind of rhetoric going back to, the 70s and 80s and 90s, in various times his famous, taking out a full page ad calling for the execution of the Central Park Five, these young men who were wrongly accused and imprisoned for the murder of a jogger in Central Park. This is all coming from the same place. It's just seeking retribution against non-white people, against foreign people, against people who we've chosen to kind of, pour our anger and grievances out on. That really just, that Pandora's box was fully opened after 9/11.
You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK. I'm Esty Chandler, very grateful to be joined today by former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, Matt Duss, now executive vice president at the Center for International Policy. KPFK is a listener-supported public radio station, part of the Pacifica Network. That's why you don't hear advertisements during our shows. We're now celebrating our 75th anniversary of being on the air, a considerable milestone for an independent media network whose idea was born out of a detention camp where conscientious objectors were forcibly detained during World War II. KPFK and the Pacifica Network were created by people who were alarmed by the power that large corporations and governments had in shaping the stories that we are told, which in turn shape the public narrative. Sound familiar? KPFK and Pacifica took the bold move not to rely on corporations or a government for funding, and instead, for all these years, we have relied on the community that we serve, both by inviting people to donate their time and labor to this endeavor and by reaching out to the community we serve, to you, our audience, to donate whatever you can afford to keep the lights on and this station broadcasting. So I'm asking you now to help us keep going. Help us continue to raise the voices of people like our guest today, Matt Duss, by calling 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735, or you can donate by logging on to kpfk.org now. Matt, Well, thousands of people continue protesting in the streets, as we saw this weekend across the country. We continue to see legislators trying to enshrine Zionist McCarthyism into law via multiple avenues, whether it be amending Title VI laws or adopting the IHRA, International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates Jewish hatred with opposition to Israeli apartheid, occupation, and genocide. Can you talk about the legislative battles that you see ahead to combat this Zionist McCarthyism we're seeing sweep the nation?
Yeah, well, first I would say it is important for people to understand and acknowledge and appreciate that anti-Semitism is very much on the rise in this. There's real data to support this. I think we see even, you know, whether if people are on social media, I'm sure that they've seen a massive upsurge in this kind of language. And that is very troubling. And I think all of your listeners, and certainly speaking for myself, that is not the country. I don't want that in my country. That's not the kind of country I want to live in. I will say at the same time, while rising anti-Semitism is clearly a problem that we need to address, we also see some forces who, as you said, have been trying to conflate this with criticism of Israeli government policy. We see this at the state level, where you've seen a number of so-called anti-boycott laws passed, where, you know, in order to receive state funds, individuals have to essentially pledge allegiance to the state of Israel, or at least promise that they will not boycott the state of Israel, which are, of course, a form of constitutionally protected speech. So it's saying that in order to receive certain funds, you can't use your speech against this one foreign country, which is just kind of bizarre. And yes, even at the national level, we do see efforts to more or less enshrine the IRA definition, as it's called, of anti-Semitism, which I would note, one of the authors of which, my good friend Ken Stern, who drafted the original language that is now being used as this definition, opposes its adoption and codification, because he said it's meant as a guide just to understand and identify what anti-Semitism is. Certainly, sometimes criticism of Israeli government policy can, you know, shade over into anti-Semitism, depending on the language that people use, whether it's just, you know, holding all Jews responsible for Israeli government actions, which we should, of course, not do. But still, he opposes that, as do, I think, many constitutional scholars, legal scholars, and Jewish leaders. But I do think, unfortunately, you do see, some more influential organizations like the ADL, like the AJC, like AIPAC, and others who support this codification precisely because it enables them to win a policy argument by making it about bigotry. And so I think it's important to understand that distinction there. I think those of us who are critical of Israeli government policy, it is a policy argument we are trying to have. And it is important to be careful not to cross the line. And to be clear, that as I was tried to be clear just now, that anti-Semitism and bigotry against Muslims and others, all of these things are a real problem in our country, and we have a responsibility to combat them. But I think this conflation is really dangerous and threatens Americans' constitutional rights.
Right. And many Jewish Americans like myself would also say that it is also anti-Semitic to assume that all Jews necessarily support the government of the state of Israel, which I've been pretty clear about on the air. Matt, it was your tweet this week, quote, "This city is thrumming with birth pangs of a new Middle East energy," end quote. Just as Israel began the expansion of their war into Lebanon, that got me thinking about the invasion of Iraq and your foreign policy piece about acknowledging the failures of the war on terror. Can you talk about this zeitgeist in D.C. that you were tweeting about in regard to the expanding war at this extremely consequential moment in U.S. history and those thrums that you are hearing?
Yeah. Well, listeners probably will remember that reference. It's to something that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said during the Bush administration and during the 2006 war between Hezbollah and Israel, a hugely destructive war, a relatively short war compared to what we've seen in Gaza. But what it said, you know, she was asked, and it was clearly a failure of Bush administration policy, who had chosen to invade Iraq, who had chosen a number of other policies across the region, which were in the midst of falling apart, you know, provoking, you know, destabilizing the region even further. Obviously, Iraq itself was an absolute mess at that point. There had been millions of people displaced. I think already over 100,000 people killed. But that quote, I think, is important because it kind of demonstrates this idea among Washington policymakers that war creates opportunities, that we can use the tool of military violence to kind of reset the table and create new pathways toward advancing our security and our prosperity and the security and the prosperity, or at least the stability of the Middle East. And I think that is a fantasy. It is a dangerous fantasy. It is a deeply immoral and inhumane way to approach policy. And excuse me. And I am just really troubled that I'm feeling that energy right now. We see a lot of people in Washington. I mean, we always see this from certain members of Congress, but, you know, from various Washington think tanks, even from people inside, unfortunately, this administration, who seem to be convinced that, well, okay, we're just going to kind of let the Israeli military do its thing, and then this might lead to a good outcome. Again, I think, how many times do we have to learn this lesson? Like, even if there were the possibility of creating a better outcome, the human costs of what we are seeing, just tens and tens of thousands of people, many times more than that, hundreds of thousands of people maimed, millions of people displaced. We are now seeing over 1 million already displaced in Lebanon. So again, there is this, you know, sense of kind of exultation and excitement about using military violence again to create the opportunity for policy goals or big wins that I find just offensive, and it really concerns me, and it frankly frustrates me. I think we've in many ways been having a better foreign policy conversation, a more diverse foreign policy conversation in Washington for some time, in part because it was so widely accepted that the Iraq war was a huge disaster. And yet we see that Washington's kind of professional foreign policy class is ready to just jump on board another crazy misadventure right now.
Right. And how in your estimation do we change that thrum in Washington? There's people in the streets by the thousands. How do we get them to listen in this, you know, such an important time?
I mean, first is to continue to support and protect members of Congress who are taking a more critical view, who are telling the truth, who are, you know, criticizing this approach, who are criticizing the administration for its failures. And I think the last year, I have a piece coming out tomorrow in the New Republic where I write more about this. This last year has been a catastrophic failure of U.S. foreign policy. I think people really need to understand that. You know, I think there have been efforts, and we see these stories coming out about how Biden tried and he kept on getting hoodwinked by Netanyahu. I don't accept that at all. I mean, the responsibility here, yes, Hamas has responsibility. Israel has responsibility. There are other actors with responsibility. But Joe Biden and his team have enormous responsibility here. And I think we need to think about what accountability really looks like. And you referenced my earlier piece on the war on terror. And part of what I wrote in that piece was we are in fact legally bound under international conventions that we have signed to hold the perpetrators of these crimes, of the war on terror, torture, rendition, accountable, which we have never done. And I think that also holds true to the Biden administration. That I think that accountability is in some ways less severe, but I think our obligation is still there. We know that they have been continuing to send weapons even while they knew for a fact that Israel was withholding aid to Gaza. That is a crime under international law, and it is a crime under U.S. law. So I think we need to think about this word accountability and what this means, because that is the only way we are going to prevent this from happening again.
That's right. And, you know, new reports coming out now about our government's complicity in blocking aid from getting in. I have no doubt that as soon as more evidence comes out, we will be reading from you about that in a very serious way, as always. Matt, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your weekend to join us. We will link to your piece coming out tomorrow at the New Republic. And, you know, thank you for all of your very cogent analysis. It really helps people who are paying attention to understand what's happening.
Thank you. And thank you for the work that you do. And I'm very glad to be with you.
Thank you. Last week, on behalf of the Center for International Policy, Matt Dess issued a statement regarding Israel's recent escalation and ground offensive in Lebanon, where he pointed out that, quote, the Israeli government's decision to dramatically escalate its attacks in Lebanon is a dangerous gamble that risks the lives of countless Lebanese, Israeli, Palestinian, and other civilians across the region, end quote. He noted that, quote, this escalation comes after months of Prime Minister Netanyahu rejecting U.S. efforts to secure a ceasefire in Gaza, and that, as we know from the very recent past, the potential for protracted deadly escalation is significant. Israel has been caught in a costly quagmire in Lebanon before, one that ultimately did not defeat Hezbollah or provide lasting security on its northern border. And Israeli military assault on Lebanon that employs the same methods or maximalist objectives as the nearly year-old war in Gaza threatens to cause even more devastation and death, with civilians bearing the brunt of the carnage, end quote. He also admonished that the Biden administration is right to seek de-escalation, but must realize that months of failure to impose meaningful consequences on Netanyahu for grave international humanitarian law violations and obstructing a ceasefire in Gaza has contributed to the disregard for U.S. and international concerns with which Israel has now acted in Lebanon. The ability of the United States to prevent an all-out war that could draw in the U.S. and Iran and imperil millions in the region, including American personnel, rests on whether President Biden is finally willing to take the steps necessary, including suspending offensive weapons deliveries to prevent a horrific conflagration, end quote. Negwa and I take the responsibility of bringing our audience the truth, of bringing you expert voices like that of Matt Dess, not only on the international crisis of an ongoing genocide in Gaza, but the emergency of our own government and our own public and private institutions materially supporting it. I'm asking you, our audience, to please help us now. Help us continue to bring you important voices like that of Matt Dess by making a pledge today. You can do that by calling 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. Or you can log on to kpfk.org to make a contribution there and keep Middle East in Focus and the other great informative shows on KPFK on the air. As you've been hearing all year, KPFK and the Pacifica Network continue to live on the edge. Please don't let us fall over that edge and off the air, which has happened in the history of this network due to the lack of funding. The stakes are incredibly high right now. We just cannot allow it to happen again. We're all hands on deck here doing what we can to keep bringing you the news and information you rely on us for. Please help us continue doing that by calling 818-985-5735 or logging on to kpfk.org and making a pledge today. Once again, I want to thank our guest, Center for International Policy Executive Vice President Matt Dess. I also want to thank Gary Baca for his production support today. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esty Chandler, thanking you for taking this time to put the Middle East in focus.
When we say this is listener-supported free speech radio,